I'm Sunny Miller, director of Trap Rock Peace Center, here with David Dashefsky, our wonderful summer intern in 2005, reflecting together on Scott Ritter's interesting challenges offered to us. Dave, I wonder if we could begin with the challenge he made, saying, "The peace movement has failed." As a student in the Campus Anti-War Network, you've been organizing and working with other students from across the country. How does that strike you? The peace movement has failed.
I think working, you know, with CAN since the beginning and ending up on the National Coordinating Committee, that, you know, I think most of us in the movement have realized that we're taking a principled position. I know there are some people who have been distraught about the war, that aren't happy that it's going on, but I don't think the fact that we haven't stopped the war means that we have failed. Those are two very different things. By purely existing, the peace movement has succeeded in, you know, demonstrating to the government that there is dissidence, that, you know, we're not some homogenous body that necessarily agrees with what the government's doing, and that this war is a bad idea. And, you know, expecting, you know, hegemon to listen just because you tell him something's a bad idea, you know, isn't necessarily the result you're going to get, but it doesn't mean that you're doing the wrong thing by telling him it's a bad idea.
I appreciated his challenge to some degree. I mean, I think that if there are folks who only want to go to a big demonstration and pat themselves on the back, that's certainly not adequate. I don't know very many people in that category. People I know are devoting their lives, doing everything they can, being very creative, very thoughtful, doing research, making research available, explaining to our senators that there's quite clear evidence that all of these claims made by the Bush administration about weapons of mass destruction were false. We brought Scott Ritter's message to Senator Kerry on the Foreign Relations Committee. He was not allowed to speak. And I appreciated that Scott turned to the people in the room and said, I'm not necessarily directing this comment to you all.
It's to some extent, it's a valid challenge. Millions of people showed up on February 15th before the war started. And, you know, it's quite obvious that some of those people did want to be at a rally and pat themselves on the back. But there are hundreds of thousands of people in the United States that work hard every day to try to end this war and to work for peace. And, you know, those people haven't failed and they've kept going. They haven't given up. They haven't decided to go home or say, okay, too bad, we didn't stop the war, we're done now. That's not something the peace movement has done.
Mm-hmm. I also appreciated Scott's challenge to us to work with veterans and soldiers. And I felt encouraged by this remark because we've been working with soldiers and veterans like Scott and many others for quite some time. And I know you have as well.
Camp, we've been working heavily with Military Families Speak Out and with Iraq Veterans Against War. In fact, Mike Hoffman was one of the co-founders of Iraq Veterans Against War, has been at all of our national conferences so far, and he's been instrumental to the work that we've done as an organization. So I don't think the peace movement would be where it is right now without veterans and without soldiers. And I think fundamentally what we're doing is, you know, advocating for their rights as much as we're advocating to end war.
Well said. We've been very gratified to see that when we bring forward the message of a Gulf War veteran like Gerard Matthew, locally, we've been able to break the pattern of not hearing those voices on some of our media. And so we're very grateful that a local NPR station, WFCR, picked up Gerard's story about his own terrible exposure to depleted uranium and his daughter's birth defect. And so I think the public and the media both listen better when veterans speak their very personal truth and give this nightmare, this abstract nightmare, a very precise picture of a precise snapshot.
I think it comes down to what Elie Wiesel's line about the Holocaust was, which is that, you know, large numbers are abstract. And, you know, 6 million is a number, 100,000 is a headline, 10,000 is a blurb. You know, 100 is a paragraph, and, you know, only with one person do you really get a full story. And I think that's what the situation is in the movement, that you need individual stories from veterans, so you're not looking at, you know, 1,700 dead or 40,000 dead or hundreds of thousands of people exposed, but rather at one individual story, because people understand stories more than they understand numbers.
Well said again. And I think that we'll continue to work with soldiers and veterans. I would criticize the movement more for not working directly with Iraqis. They're a bit harder to find, perhaps.
A little tougher to get access.
But their stories are really, they've been missing too much. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we can work with Dar Jamal and others to get more contact and hear more directly from victims of war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and still in Bosnia and Afghanistan, and even the victims of war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Their stories still need to be told.
They do.
What did you think of Scott's challenge, saying that many U.S. citizens seem to be more concerned about their cocoon of comfort than the reality that their rights are being stripped away?
I mean, I think that he has a very valid point to make, and this isn't, you know, a new idea in governance. If you have a little familiarity with history, you know, the Italians loved Mussolini for the first 10 years he was in power because he provided them. He put food on the table. He provided the lowest rate of unemployment they had had in over 100 years. And he provided education. And when you give people education, food, clothing, and a place to work, apparently, you know, they'll forget about their fundamental rights. And in the United States, you know, it's not food, clothes, and shelter. It's an SUV and cable television and central air. But apparently, we're willing to give up, you know, our fundamental rights as Americans. You know, Constitution says that we hold these truths to be self-evident. And, you know, we're not holding anything to be self-evident anymore. We're giving up these fundamental rights that our founding fathers took from Locke and took from Rousseau. And, you know, we're exchanging them for, you know, for a new car. And I don't think that, you know, that's a really fair trade.
When I think about people giving up their rights, it reminds me of situations in some workplaces where discussing current events is simply taboo and too controversial. I hope that's less and less true in workplaces. I hope that people are speaking their minds in the grocery store, at the coffee shop, and at work, and at church or at temple, and that this right to speak, to freedom of the press, you know, we've got to insist more on.
We've elected a president who's putting forward candidates for the Supreme Court who have said that, you know, the constitutional separation of church and state is a manufactured fiction. And, you know, anyone who's, you know, read their United States history and understands our founding fathers knows that this idea of a high wall of separation comes from Jefferson and isn't a manufactured fiction.
Mm. David, you're a political science major at Geneseo College, and so you have been reading your American history, happily. Speaking of American history, Scott emphasized very strongly that we need to not only study the Constitution, but hold the Constitution as a core value that is our common mm-hmm. bond. What would you say to that point?
I'd agree with it, although to an extent the Constitution is a rather arcane document. You have the freedom to arm yourself in a state militia against tyranny. You have the freedom to protect yourself from the British government seizing your home to house soldiers, which is interesting because, you know, some more activist judges have decided this means that eminent domain should be out the door. But that's a whole other story. So in many ways, the Constitution is rather arcane and rather vague. But the ideas that it's founded upon, particularly the ideas in the Bill of Rights of a free press and freedom of speech, and as interpreted with freedom of symbolic speech and a right to habeas corpus and a right to a fair trial before a jury of your peers, these are things that we should hold on to as Americans. And, you know, people being held in limbo in Guantanamo Bay, being denied habeas corpus, and being held up on trial before a military tribunal rather than by a judge and a jury of their peers should, you know, pop out at people, and people should be like, hey, you know, something's not right here. This is fundamentally un-American. This isn't how we do things.
I wonder if the Campus Anti-War Network has been visiting high schools and even middle schools to visit with students and talk about the Bill of Rights and how we can practice the Bill of Rights and insist upon it and speak up for those in our communities who are being imprisoned as
unfortunately,
detainees.
Unfortunately, the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to anyone under the age of 18. So while we do have high school chapters in Canada, the Supreme Court has, you know, essentially ruled that certain parties have in loco parentis powers, which is in place of parents, and that all constitutional rights of children are invested in their parents until they are legally emancipated or 18 years old. So they don't really have any of those rights. Which I think is a little bit of a hole in the American system. But
But are you visiting the high schools schools?
We have done outreach to high schools. We haven't done outreach to middle schools. In fact, we have high school chapters of Campus Anti-War Network.
I think of, you know, young energy as having a lot of energy for rebellion and resistance. And I would think parents would be very grateful for that energy to be turned into a very fruitful avenue of speaking out against oppression of government rather than oppression of parents.
I know a lot of parents that wouldn't be happy if the radical left was talking to their 12-year-old, but that's a whole other story.
I don't really see the peace movement in terms of right and left. I differ with you in that analysis of what is the peace movement, and I perhaps am somewhat in line with Scott in thinking that this is a common thread that all U.S. citizens could really hold more dear, not perhaps as a cherished and or perfect document, but as something important, and that whether we're addressing our rights to have low-power radio stations
I think it's sad that we live in a country where the ACLU feels that there's, you know, a need to print out your basic rights on, you know, a 5x7 card so that you know what rights you're entitled to if you're arrested. I'd hope that we live in a country where people understand their basic rights to love, where they don't need, you know, a little card to remind them, where that's not an advocacy campaign that millions of dollars need to be poured into every year. Unfortunately, that's not the case, and it's a failure of our educational system. They don't want to teach people what rights they really have. They want to teach them to be, you know, quote, productive citizens, you know, to have a job and pay their taxes. That's what the educational system's there for. It's not to teach people what their basic rights are.
Well, maybe our schools are not promoting the cocoon of comfort so much as simply a cocoon. Mm-hmm. And I know many wonderful people working in the schools. So I don't mean to generalize too much, but I think that there is...
I was addressing the fundamental purpose of education, not educators. I think our teachers are some of the most important people, but the system itself is almost working against them.
Mm-hmm. How could that be improved?
You could let teachers teach instead of having a state-mandated curriculum with standardized tests attached to it. Because, you know, if you're forcing teachers to teach a state-mandated government curriculum that you're going to give students a standardized test from in order for them to graduate, that's the government curriculum they're going to be learning.
I guess one of the ways I'd like to see education improved is that history classes would focus less on the history of war and the win-lose paradigm and introduce the concept that Jeanette Rankin spoke of, saying, the first woman elected to Congress, saying, you can no more win a war than you can win an earthquake. And perhaps this brings up a final point that we might address in this little reflection. Scott said that the peace movement might want to join with the Marines in thinking that the world's nastiest military, I'm paraphrasing here, might be the best deterrent to war we could have. That point, I think, many of the audience would disagree with. Would you like to comment on that?
I think that, you know, the United States has maintained the world's meanest, nastiest military since World War II continuously, and it hasn't stopped us from using it. Didn't stop us in Korea, didn't stop us in Vietnam, didn't stop us in the first Gulf War in Afghanistan or in Iraq. And it looks as though it's not going to stop us in the future with the people in power that we have now. So having the nasty military isn't going to stop you from using it. While I think, you know, we have a vested interest in being able to provide for self-defense, that doesn't mean we need the biggest, meanest, nastiest military in the world. That just doesn't work. It creates a culture of fear and a culture of violence. and an attitude of arrogance that, you know, we can steamroll over anyone we want. And we've shown that we will steamroll over anyone we want. It's not an arbitrary threat. It's something we're willing to do.
I think as you say that, one interpretation that comes to mind for me is that if you do hold that we need the world's largest, nastiest military, I think it seeps into becoming a core value. I don't think that as human beings we are able to distinguish so clearly between a skill and a value. And so that the skill of killing starts to morph into the value of killing.
To go back to the point I was making about the Constitution, this is why the Founding Fathers had this idea of a very minimal standing military, and that's where this notion of state militias comes about, is they felt that, you know, the British military equaled tyranny, and that military equals tyranny, and that the only force that needed to be maintained was a navy because they need people who knew how to use ships. But other than that, it should be a state militia structure that were called upon when they were needed. And, you know, that's what our Founding Fathers envisioned, because they felt that that was the way to truly promote democracy, not having a large standing professional military.
Good point. I think also that if we look at history, we can see that having the world's nastiest military means that we are affected by it daily. Here in Massachusetts, the Fernald Boys School had a science experiment going on that was partly helped along by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Boys at this school were enticed to join the science club to make their lives more interesting, and were fed a radioactive oatmeal for breakfast and studied to see the results.
Lovely. This,
well, and unfortunately, the book The Plutonium Files by Eileen Wellsom chronicles a long history of experiments on unsuspecting citizens, women expecting that they were taking nutritional supplements. I believe that was at Vanderbilt University. Prisoners signing up for experiments. Life was dull, and a little bit of monetary incentive was enough.
To our military all the time, though. They don't have a right to refuse health care treatments. We experimented on radiation therapy in large doses, vaccines that haven't been deemed safe for the public. These are things that are fine to do with the military. The Tuskegee experiment was technically legal when they didn't treat people in the military for syphilis. That's fine in the structure that we've created. It's not ethical. It's not right, but it is legal, and that's something we need to fix.
That's astonishing to me. So many of us have heard about the Tuskegee experiment, you know, and we're aghast, and we're dismayed to learn the history of atomic veterans asked to march to Ground Zero in the thick of an atomic cloud in order to see whether the military can successfully direct soldiers in an atomic war, and then to find out the results later. How will it affect the fighting force? We're aghast to hear of these incidents, but I'm afraid that it isn't one incident and another. It is instead the direct result of holding a value for being the most powerful dominating force in the use of violence. And instead, if we held the value of developing the art of persuasion, diplomacy, and effective citizen action through the use of nonviolence, we could inoculate our citizenry against occupation from outside forces. And what a challenge we have. Now we are occupied by a very threatening force from inside our own government.
To close with a historical parable, it was actually a story that was written by the victors. But the myth of, you know, the obedient, militaristic Spartan boy who has a fox climb up into his pant leg and, you know, rather than, you know, eliminate it and chew it out, ends up bleeding to death. This is actually a story that came from the Athenians because they ended up winning out in that conflict. And it was an example of core democratic values over militarism. And I think we're trying to place Americans in that same sort of complacent
position. No, I'm not
position.
Quite following what you're saying. You're saying this parable.
That the Spartans were from such a strict militaristic culture that they were so complacent as to not, you know, disobey orders, that if they were standing still in military formation, the fox climbed up the pant leg.
I see.
That they do nothing about it because they knew that it was their job to stand still. And
oh,
that,
dear.
That's not a cultural example that we want to hold up.
Well, thank you for telling that story, because it brings up the problem of the group mind, mm-hmm. which I think is fostered.
Well, it goes hand in hand with
system.
Militarism.
Mm-hmm, right. And unfortunately, with too much of our materialistic culture as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the group mind doesn't challenge us to think as individuals and to reflect with conscience. And I think Scott does really do that. I'm very grateful for him to have come to speak to us and bring up his challenges.
Scott is bright and classically educated, which are not core values in the military. In fact, those are things that are not desired in the enlisted soldier.
Mm. You've been listening to David Dashefsky, a member of the National Coordinating Committee of the Campus Anti-War Network, here as a summer intern at Trap Rock Peace Center. I'm Sunny Miller, Executive Director and active volunteer as well. We invite you to volunteer for the peace movement, to think together, to act together, to solve violence rather than to add to it. Thanks for your care and support for the peace movement.
You can find more information online at www.traprockpeace.org.
Or at your website, Dave.
Which is
www.campusantiwar.net. Thank you very much, and thanks to Ed Russell for taping this recording.